Today is Thursday, November 13th, and this is the World Socialist Website. Hands Off Latin America, Halt Trump's Killing Spree, by Bill Van Auken. The sailing of the aircraft carrier USS Gerald R. Ford into Caribbean waters has dramatically escalated the threat of an imminent U.S. imperialist war against Venezuela and Latin America more broadly. The U.S. military escalation comes close on the heels of War Secretary Peter Hegseth's latest triumphant announcement of a pair of U.S. missile strikes over the weekend, sinking two small boats and killing six more people. This has brought the death toll from the Trump administration's criminal murder spree against unarmed civilians off South America's coast to at least 76. There have been 20 such attacks since they began on September 2nd, evenly split between the southern Caribbean waters off Venezuela and the eastern Pacific coast of Colombia. Having carried out a savage series of what the United Nations has described as extrajudicial executions and war crimes, U.S. imperialism is now preparing far greater atrocities. The USS Ford, the U.S. Navy's largest warship, is accompanied by three guided missile destroyers and over 4,000 personnel that make up its strike group. They are joining a U.S. armada of at least eight warships, including a nuclear submarine, and a combined force of more than 10,000 sailors and marines already deployed near Venezuela's shores. This vast military force is augmented by a fleet of 10 F-35 strike fighters deployed to the recently reopened Roosevelt Roads Naval Station in Puerto Rico, as well as provocative flights by B-52 bombers near Venezuelan shores. U.S. soldiers and Marines are carrying out exercises in both Puerto Rico and, for the first time in decades, Panama, in preparation for combat deployment. U.S. military analysts have described the U.S. naval force off the northern tip of South America as the largest assembled since the first U.S. Gulf War against Iraq in 1991. It is by far the largest force deployed in the region since the 1989 U.S. invasion of Panama. The claim that this unprecedented deployment is for the purpose of interdicting cocaine shipments is patently absurd. What is being prepared is a full-scale imperialist war, with incalculable consequences. The Center for Strategic and International Studies, or CSIS, a Washington-based think tank with intimate ties to the U.S. military intelligence apparatus, noted that the U.S. carrier strike group is, quote, poorly structured for counter-drug operations, but well-structured for strikes against Venezuela, unquote. It compared the U.S. deployment to, quote, an archer with an arrow drawn. The stance is unstable, either launch or stand down, unquote. That the Trump administration is preparing to drag the American people into yet another war of aggression based upon lies has been clear from the outset of its Caribbean killing spree. The designation of Venezuelan and Colombian fishermen as enemy combatants and narco-terrorists in no way legalizes their slaughter. In the pretense that Venezuela is a significant source for the flow of drugs to the U.S., is belied by every credible report from both U.S. intelligence and international agencies. What are the real aims of the would-be dictator Donald Trump and the financial oligarchy that he represents? To topple the government of Nicolas Maduro and impose a fascist U.S. puppet dictatorship in its place? To secure unrestrained U.S. corporate control over Venezuela's oil reserves, the largest on the planet, so as to deny them to Washington's principal strategic rival, China, and prepare for global war? To stave off economic crisis and financial collapse through outright plunder, and to impose the shackles of U.S. neo-colonial subjugation not only on Venezuela, but the entire Western Hemisphere. The U.S. escalation was accompanied by a report Tuesday that the British government has ordered a halt to intelligence sharing with the U.S. on drug trafficking in the Caribbean, where London still controls a few island remnants of its former empire. The reason given is that the U.K. does not want to implicate itself in war crimes against the unarmed civilians being blown out of the water by U.S. missiles. But British imperialism has fought shoulder to shoulder with the U.S. in previous criminal wars of mass slaughter, from Korea to the Balkans, Afghanistan, Iraq, and Libya. If it is expressing qualms this time, it is no doubt due to imperialist interests, rather than any newfound moral scruples. The British ruling class, on one hand, fears that it will be left out of any carve-up of Venezuela, and, on the other, is increasingly at odds with Washington on everything from the Ukraine war to ever-changing American tariffs. Of far greater weight in terms of counter-narcotics is the announcement Tuesday by the Colombian government that it is halting all intelligence sharing with Washington. According to U.S. officials, Colombia has provided 85% of all actionable intelligence used by the Florida-based Joint Interagency Task Force South, or GIATF, to interdict illegal drug trafficking. Colombia broke off these ties following the inadvertent release of a photograph of a top U.S. official at the White House, holding a document with the headline, "The Trump Doctrine for Colombia and the Western Hemisphere," over an AI-generated photograph depicting Venezuelan President Maduro and Colombia's President Gustavo Petro side-by-side in orange prison jumpsuits. The document itself calls for extending the foreign terrorist organization designation to Colombian drug traffickers, support for anti-Petro forces in Colombia, and trumped-up criminal charges against Petro so he, like Maduro, can have a $50 million bounty placed on his head. Petro, who has described the U.S. military's killing of Venezuelans and other Latin Americans on small boats as murder, demanded that Washington provide an explanation for the document. Instead, it responded with still more calumnies. Deputy Secretary of State Christopher Landau declared, quote, "It's very tragic for the Colombian people that they are represented by a person of such low moral character," unquote, predicting that, quote, "the Colombian people, in its great wisdom, will reject this path, leading to misery, hate, and will go another way," unquote. What is the Trump Doctrine, or, as it is cynically referred to in the White House, the Monroe Doctrine? The seminal Monroe Doctrine was promulgated in 1823 as a warning against any attempt by the reactionary monarchical powers of Europe to recolonize the newly independent republics of Latin America. With the rise of U.S. imperialism, however, it underwent profound changes as the U.S. laid claim to Spain's colonies in the 1898 Spanish-American War and suppressed the revolutionary strivings of the peoples of those colonies, particularly in Cuba, in order to assert U.S. domination. In 1904, President Teddy Roosevelt unveiled the so-called Big Stick Corollary to the doctrine, arrogating to U.S. imperialism the right to exercise police power wherever it perceived, quote, "wrongdoing or impotence," unquote, in the hemisphere. This set the stage for some 50 direct U.S. military interventions. By the latter half of the 20th century, the doctrine became inextricably intertwined with the Cold War in a global anti-communist crusade that saw U.S.-backed fascist military dictatorships take power through much of South and Central America, murdering, torturing, and imprisoning hundreds of thousands of workers, students, and other opponents of U.S. domination and military rule. The Trump Doctrine retains all of the counter-revolutionary features that emerged in the 20th century, but stripped of any of the hypocritical pretense that Washington is pursuing lofty goals of freedom and democracy. It consists of nothing more than the gangster insistence that U.S. might makes right, and that Washington will seize whatever its military power allows it. An attack on Venezuela would be only the starting point for U.S. aggression throughout the region. U.S. officials are reportedly viewing a war in South America through the lens of the 1989 Panama invasion, when Noriega was brought back to the U.S. to stand trial on drug trafficking charges. Venezuela, however, has a geographical area 12 times that of Panama, and its population is 10 times Panama's of 35 years ago. Moreover, the U.S. has no military presence in Venezuela, while Panama was bifurcated by the U.S.-run Panama Canal Zone, with multiple military bases and some 13,000 U.S. troops stationed there. The CSIS report injects a note of sobriety into the war-drunk atmosphere in Washington, warning that, while the U.S. is capable of launching, quote, an extended air campaign consisting of a series of attacks to paralyze and destabilize the Maduro regime, unquote, such campaigns, quote, have only succeeded when coupled with the threat or reality of a ground campaign, unquote, invoking the aftermath of the Shock and Awe campaign against Iraq in 2003, it warns that the U.S.-backed right-wing opposition may prove too weak to, quote, exert control over the country once it takes power, unquote, leaving the Trump administration to face, quote, the kind of protracted military effort it has tried to avoid, unquote. That is, another forever war, this time in its own backyard. U.S. imperialism's foreign policy is an extension of its domestic policy by other means. Washington is preparing to launch a war against Venezuela, even as the Trump administration proclaims its war against U.S. cities and the enemy within. It has waged a pitiless police state operation against immigrant workers, including, paradoxically, stripping some 600,000 Venezuelans of temporary protection status, a measure that is deeply unpopular in Venezuela. Meanwhile, it is seeking the deployment of U.S. Army troops to major urban areas to suppress opposition. Even as Trump justifies a military strike on Venezuela with his absurd claims of the Maduro government orchestrating the flow of migrants driven by Washington's own brutal economic sanctions and of running drug cartels, so it will inevitably seize upon an armed conflict in South America as the pretext for demanding even greater police state powers within the U.S. itself. Washington is driven to seek, by means of criminal violence, solutions to intractable problems rooted in the contradictions of U.S. and global capitalism. There is an appearance of lunacy in the war aims of U.S. imperialism in Latin America. It cannot reverse the rise of China as South America's premier trading partner with bombs and missiles outside of an all-out world war. But that, along with the drive towards fascist dictatorship, is the road upon which it is marching. U.S. armed aggression against Venezuela will set a flame to a social and political powder keg in Latin America, while arousing the deep-seated opposition in the U.S. to militarism in the inevitable social attacks that will accompany another U.S. war. War cannot be stopped by relying on the supposed opposition to Trump of the Democratic Party. It was the Obama administration that first declared a state of national emergency in 2015, branding Venezuela, quote, an unusual and extraordinary threat to the national security and foreign policy of the United States, unquote, laying the foundation for the crippling sanctions aimed at starving Venezuela into submission and unending regime change operations. The decree was renewed by both the Trump and the Biden administrations. Whatever differences the Democrats have with Trump, largely centered on their demand for a more bellicose policy toward Russia, they, above all, fear a mass revolt from below. At the same time, the Maduro government, representing the interests of sections of the Venezuelan bourgeoisie and foreign capital, is incapable of making any genuine anti-imperialist appeal to the working class and the oppressed masses of Venezuela and the Americas. Workers on both sides of the Rio Grande must grasp the reality that they are the real target of imperialism and must join hands across national borders in a unified struggle against imperialist war and to put an end to the capitalist system, which is its source. Mom Donnie reassures Wall Street with deputy mayor appointment by Daniel DeVries. New York City Mayor-elect Zohran Mamdani announced Tuesday the first appointments of his incoming administration, including Dean Fuleihan, a Democratic Party insider, as his first deputy mayor, the unusually early appointment just a week after Mamdani's election victory of the longtime operative sends a clear signal that his incoming administration will operate well within the limits acceptable to the political establishment. Fuleihan, who is 74 years old, has been involved in Democratic politics in New York for 5 decades. Most recently, he was appointed by Governor Kathy Hochul to the New York Financial Control Board, which was created amid the city's near bankruptcy in 1975, to enforce budgetary discipline on behalf of finance capital. Mamdani tapped Fuleihan to return to the role he held from 2018 to 2021 under Mayor Bill de Blasio. Prior to that, Fuleihan was de Blasio's budget director, where he was responsible for negotiating contracts with the city's 300,000-strong municipal workforce. Fuleihan worked with the union bureaucrats to set pattern contracts with around 2% annual wage increases, together with cuts to benefits, including setting the stage for the privatization of healthcare for city retirees. Resolving these contracts, all of which had been expired for years, on terms advantageous to the city without provoking mass worker resistance, was one of the principal tasks facing the de Blasio administration. Fuleihan has also held several positions in the State Assembly, rising to become the right-hand man of former Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver. Silver was the embodiment of the Democratic Party establishment in Albany, a capitalist power broker known as one of the, quote, three men in a room, unquote, alongside the governor and state Senate majority leader, who controlled state government. Ultimately, Silver died in prison in 2022. While serving a 6.5-year term for taking $4 million in bribes. Speaking of Fuleihan to City and State, Kathy Wild, the CEO of the Business Association Partnership for New York City, quipped, quote, "He knows where all the bodies are buried. Let's put it that way," unquote. Mamdani's appointment of Fuleihan drew praise from other quarters as well, including U.S. Representative from the Bronx, Richie Torres, an outspoken defender of Israel's genocide in Gaza. Torres was a bitter opponent of Mamdani in the primary. He called Mamdani's Democratic Socialists of America, or DSA, quote, "despicable, detestable, disgraceful, and disgraced," unquote. On Monday, Torres posted on X, quote, "There are a few people on earth who know the workings of city and state government as deeply as Dean Fuleihan, who has served as the first deputy mayor of NYC, the director of NYC OMB, the chief fiscal advisor to the assembly speaker, and a seasoned negotiator on the state budget. An exceptional appointment in more ways than one," unquote. Governor Hochul added her support for the appointment as well, writing that Fuleihan's, quote, "experience and integrity will be invaluable in this role, a great choice and a win for New Yorkers." Alongside the appointment of Fuleihan, Mamdani announced that L. Biscard Church, his chief of staff while he was a state assemblyman, will continue in that role when Mamdani is sworn in as mayor. Biscard Church headed up Mamdani's mayoral campaign. Like the mayor-elect, she is a member of the DSA in New York City. This week's appointments follow Mamdani's announcement last week of his transition team, which will, among other things, make recommendations for candidates to fill the remaining posts of the incoming administration. The five women who make up this team are notable for their continuity with previous mayoral administrations. They served not only under de Blasio, but also the outgoing administration of Eric Adams, the corrupt former cop and Trump ally, as well as the billionaire Michael Bloomberg, who bankrolled Andrew Cuomo's failed mayoral bid. One member of Mamdani's transition team, Lina Khan, who previously served on Biden's Federal Trade Commission, was praised last year by Trump's Vice President J.D. Vance. In the closing week of the campaign, Mamdani announced that he supported retaining Jessica Tisch as the head of the NYPD, meeting one of the key demands of New York's business elite. Tisch has not said whether she will accept the offer to stay on. By staffing his administration with Democratic Party operatives acceptable to the city's corporate and financial leaders, Mamdani is underscoring that his incoming administration is not aimed at breaking the stranglehold of the ruling oligarchy, but instead working with them to contain opposition. The situation facing broad masses of workers in New York City, as elsewhere around the country, is explosive. Social conditions are characterized above all by a deepening social crisis in which the cost of housing, food, transportation, and other necessities is increasingly out of reach. At the same time, the level of wealth of the top layers on Wall Street and in corporate suites is obscene. Mamdani attracted the largest number of votes in over 50 years, based on his appeal to rein in higher prices and thus deal with the affordability crisis. The broad popular discontent behind Mamdani's election is what has fueled the vicious attacks on the mayor-elect from the Trump administration. What those who voted for Mamdani are getting, however, is misdirection, a fresh face that rhetorically speaks to workers' concerns, while behind the scenes preparing an administration staffed by those with a long history of serving the ruling class. Mamdani's appointment of Fulahan is a demonstration that the new mayor will abide by the dictates of the ruling class. His promises of free childcare, free buses, and a rent freeze are contingent upon whatever they are willing to accept. He is speaking to the oligarchs to reassure them, not to mobilize a struggle against them. Speaking to reporters at a New York Democratic Party conference in Puerto Rico Saturday, Governor Hochul ruled out one of Mamdani's key planks, free buses. Quote, "I cannot set forth a plan right now that takes money out of a system that relies on the fares of the buses and the subways. But can we find a path to make it more affordable for people who need help? Of course we can," unquote. Mamdani, meanwhile, at the same conference, stressed his desire for unity with Hochul and the rest of the Democratic Party machine. Quote, "Together in this room, on this stage, I feel something that has felt all too rare in our politics, a united front," he said, transforming the historical meaning of the United Front as an alliance of the working class against capitalist barbarism into its opposite, the subordination of the struggle of workers to the oldest capitalist party in the U.S. This has been Paul Fuller for the World Socialist Website.
The World Socialist Website is published by the International Committee of the Fourth International, the ICFI, the leadership of the World Socialist Movement, the Fourth International founded by Leon Trotsky in 1938. The World Socialist Website relies entirely on the donations of readers and listeners for financial support. To give to the WSWS or to set up a regular monthly contribution, go to wsws.org/donate. We urge our listeners to join the International Committee of the Fourth International and one of its affiliated political parties and take up the struggle for socialism.